Acts chapter 9 and verse 31 is where we will begin. I invite you to turn to your New Testaments to that spot. Acts chapter 9, verse 31, we're going to be looking at the third attribute that's described in this verse about why God's kingdom grew the way it did, why the book of Acts happened the way that it happens. Acts chapter 9, verse 31 says this: "So the church throughout all Judea and Galilee and Samaria had peace and was being built up and walking in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Spirit, it multiplied." If you go back to the Old Testament, especially to the books of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, you very quickly understand that the fear of the Lord is both the foundation, the cornerstone, and it's also the capstone of our spiritual lives. Because the very first part of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7 says, "The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord." And the close of Ecclesiastes, chapter 12, verse 13, after he says, "The end of the matter, all has been heard," what is it? Fear the Lord. That's everything about us. That's the whole of man, keeping his ways. So fearing God is not something that we outgrow. It's not something that we do for a little while and then graduate from and go into other more important spiritual things. It is the whole of our walk with God. It's what everything depends on. If anything, we go deeper into the fear of God, not farther away from it. And so that is a very key part of then why, in Acts 9, the church does what it does. It walks in the fear of the Lord. And so from a worldly perspective, Christianity is terrifying for what it calls for the human to do if you walk in the ways of God. But from the Christian perspective, those of us who are living in fear of the Lord, it is the safest place to be. That's where we're going with this. But I want to go to the Old Testament for just a couple of different places. We're not going to look at all of these scriptures here in Deuteronomy, but I want to put them there up on the screen so that if you're writing notes, you have those to take down. I want to talk about how in the Old Testament, fear of God is a very repeated instruction. It's a component of what God's people tell other God's people to do. And specifically, it starts with Moses. When he was speaking to the Promised Land generation in the book of Deuteronomy, he said this over and over and over again. As we talked about before, the book of Deuteronomy is a neat book. It is the last words of Moses as he gets up in front of the people and he speaks to them at 120 years old, right before he goes up on Mount Nebo and sees the Promised Land and dies. He is speaking to a bunch of people who have been taught day after day because they were living in tents, because they were eating manna for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They had this constant reminder built into their everyday life to trust the Lord, to lean not upon themselves but upon Him for their nourishment, for their defense against enemies, for all the things that they needed. And so Moses is talking to them. And he's saying, you know what you guys are going into that land to receive? A mountain of blessings. You're about to enter into houses that you didn't construct. You're about to reap produce that you didn't sow. You're about to have things that you didn't work for or deserve, but they're going to be poured onto your laps. They're kind of like five-year-olds who have never seen a toy before in their lives, and somebody lets them loose in a Toys R Us. I realize Toys R Us is like defunct, but let's roll with the analogy, all right? So that's what's going to happen to them. You're going to go in there, and it's going to be mind-blowingly amazing. This promised land that's been said for decades to you that you're going to have and enjoy, it's going to be marvelous. But the danger is you're going to get in there, and you're going to fix your eyes on your blessings and forget the one who gave them to you. So, it is no surprise then, this book is chock full of the instruction to fear the Lord. I'm just going to read one of these passages from chapter 6, actually the first one there on the screen. Chapter 6, 1 and 2. "Now this is the commandment the statutes and the rules that the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, that you may do them in the land to which you are going over to possess it, that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son's son, by keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be long. It's a blessing when God provides us with permanence and security in different ways in our lives, but we need to be so careful that we don't take that security and think that that must become our God instead of Him. So that's Moses' warning to the Promised Land generation. But then Joshua, in the very next generation, right before he dies, he gets up like Moses did before all the people, and he gives a last farewell address, and he basically says the same kind of things that Moses did before in Deuteronomy. If you look over in Joshua 24, you know, this chapter is famous for the "as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord" verse, but 24:14 is really excellent as well, where he says, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord." So what Joshua does in this last chapter is he reiterates the promises that were made to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob, and the patriarchs. And then he talks about the story of the Exodus and how God led them out of slavery and into freedom. He talks about the different enemies that they fought already before they entered the Promised Land. And then after they entered the Promised Land and the deliverance that he gave from the Canaanites that were there, he gives them this brief history lesson, but then he also gives them some very dire warnings. Because he understands there's still more Canaanites to drive out. There's still more work to do. The battles are not finished yet. He is going the way of all the earth. He's dying. He's passing on. But the rest of them still need to put in the work to get everybody out of the land who was already there that shouldn't be there anymore. And so he says, look, they have idols. They have altars. And your temptation is to fix your eyes upon all of those gods that are being served around you with the Canaanite peoples. And you're already, in matter of fact, he says, you've already got idols inside your tents, inside your homes. You need to get those out as well. You need to purge yourself of all your uncleanness, and you need to purge the land. And so he gives them this instruction. The way you do that is you have a heart that fears the Lord. And so the message of fearing God didn't need to get updated after the time of Moses. It was the same thing in the next generation as well. Fearing the Lord is not like replacing furniture every 10 years in your house. It periodically just needs to get updated. There's no updating this message. There's no need for it. So regardless of the unique challenges of every generation of God's people, this is something that godly men said over and over to the next people that they passed the baton to. And you see that then with the generation of Samuel. Samuel, in chapter 12 of 1 Samuel, Samuel's not about to die, but he is about to fade into the woodwork because the first king, Saul, has been chosen by God. He's been set up in front of everybody. He is about to lead the people. And in 1 Samuel 12, what Samuel does is he gives an address to help everybody understand, here's what you did in asking for a king. Here's what the king's going to do. And here's the way that this is going to be. 1 Samuel 12, he says something very interesting. We're going to read verse 14, but he basically says the same thing in verse 24 as well. Fear the Lord. Notice how what he says. If you will fear the Lord, this is 1 Samuel 12:14, and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both you and your king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. And so part of this chapter in 1 Samuel 12 is all about how the Israelites were not fearing the Lord up to this point in time, because he says, Nahash the Ammonite king came against you. And you looked at him, you looked at the forces he was gathering and the battle that was brewing, and you said, we need a king to lead us against that guy. And so you called out for one, even though the Lord was already your king. You didn't fear him, you feared the Ammonites. And you looked at all the other nations, at their supposed security and prosperity, and you said, we've got to be like all of them, even though you were more secure than you realized. So they had a temptation to fix their eyes on other people around them, to the leadership that those nations had, and not to the leadership that they had already in their God. And that is something that we, in our culture that is so chaotic, can fall into the temptation of as well. And when you turn on your TV and you flip up your computer screen and you go to CNN and you go to the media of the world, that is the message. We just need the right king, and then everything is going to be fine. It's a lie, because we already have one. And he's much better than anybody who could ever sit in a Supreme Court office or an Oval Office or any other kind of office. Thank you. I want to talk about the book of Acts and fear of God there. You go to chapter 2, you notice something interesting that's happening after the Day of Pentecost sermon. Peter gets up and he preaches to the crowd of people who crucified Jesus. Notice what happens in Acts. So we don't just see this idea in the Old Testament baked into these generational farewell addresses that Samuel and Moses and Joshua give to the next generation's people. We also see this really happening inside Acts itself. So again, chapter 9:31 is our anchor text that we keep going back to about how the church is multiplied. Well, Acts 9:31 is not the first time that the fear of the Lord has been talked about inside of the book. So Acts chapter 2, verse 43, this is something interesting. So this is right after they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, the fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and the prayers. And a lot of your translations will say this: and awe came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were being done through the apostles. It's the ESV that I'm reading from. If you're using, I think it is the New King James or other translations, that word awe is actually replaced with the word fear. Fear came upon every soul. That's the Greek word phobos, like we get our modern word phobia from. And that word is not talking about this terror of the nations or terror of the Jewish leadership and other people around them. This is fear of the Lord. This is a good kind of fear. And notice how it's on not just a few people, a small handful of disciples. The text says it's upon every soul. Everybody is filled with this. And so what caused their worship together? What caused their fellowship? What caused their breaking of bread in homes? That is going to be talked about right after this verse in the text. All this comes back to this idea of a fear of God within them. We'll talk about that more when we get to applications in just a second. But I want us to notice that this is from the beginning of the church. And then when you go to chapter 5, there's an interesting story here about what happens to two people inside of the church, inside of the community of Jesus. And this relates to what happens in the book of Numbers. You remember at the beginning of the Old Testament covenant, as the priests were getting consecrated and they get their robes and they get their plates and they get all the things that they are going to use to serve God. And Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, they go in for the very first time to offer incense to God, and God burns them up on the spot because they did not treat God as holy in front of all the congregation in the middle of the camp. Well, at the beginning of the new covenant, there are also two people who die at the Lord's hand because they did not honor him as holy as well. These two people, Ananias and Sapphira, who both conspired together to sell some things, lay some money at the feet of the apostles, and to lie about how much they were giving to the Lord. Seemingly small thing, but God treats that as very serious and says, you're lying to the Holy Spirit. Why do you think you could get away with that? And so he died. The husband, Ananias, dies at first. Look at verse 5. He fell down and breathed his last. And notice the reaction of everybody who sees this. Great fear. Same word as 243. Same word as 931. Fear came upon all who heard of it. And then when you drop down to verse 11, after his wife does the same thing and she dies, after Peter, you know, brings her in and has a conversation with her, and she just tells the same lie again. Great fear, again, came upon not just the whole church, but upon all who heard of these things. So you get the sense that there are even non-Christians on the outside who are hearing about what's happening inside the Jesus community, and they are becoming fearful of this God as the Christians are. So God, at the beginning of both covenants, establishes the need to look at him in fear. And so this has to be baked into our church culture as well, if we as a local family of believers are going to grow in the way that God wants us to as well. But that's what happens. They do fear the Lord, and so rather unlike the Israelites, who don't fear the Lord, and in the course of their history, they do serve idols, they get carried off into exile, their nation gets destroyed completely, and even after they come back after 70 years, it's really not the same like it was before. Unlike all that, that's really a downward spiral, the new Israel, the new Jerusalem, the new family of God, it grows. It doesn't diminish in strength. It just increases. Because they're looking at Jesus and being amazed by him, instead of looking to the nations, instead of looking to idols, instead of looking to anything else. So that's our context when 931 says they're growing, partly because of this. So what I want to do with this last part of the sermon is try to bring this home to us. Because I think all of us agree, yeah, I should fear the Lord. Yeah, it's a good thing. Yeah, that's important. But how? How does the fear of the Lord actually grow us? For one thing, it strips away. It's going to strip away something and then build something up within us. So what it takes away, what it removes, is a fear of anyone or anything else. When you think about what happens in Acts, can you just make a mental list in your mind of all the things that the Christians could have been afraid of? For one thing, there are the scary people of influence that the Christians rub elbows with. There's the Jewish leadership, who prior to the book of Acts beginning had already sent Jesus Christ to the cross. And the apostles get hauled in front of the same people and have to be questioned by them. That could have been really scary, but it wasn't, because of the fear of the Lord in them. You have the Roman leadership. Obviously, you have Pilate still hanging around. But you also have the other Roman leaders that the apostles and Paul rub elbows with in the rest of the book. You also have the Jewish terrorists who follow Paul around everywhere he goes, trying to start churches and making life miserable for him in every kind of way. You have King Herod, who flexes his muscles in chapter 12 by arresting Peter and James, killing James and trying to kill Peter before the angel lets him out of this prison cell. A lot of people that the Christians could have been afraid of. And you have a lot of violence against Christians in Acts. You think about everything that Paul went through. He went through beating with rods. He went through being stoned and left for dead. He was almost ripped apart by a mob in Jerusalem because they thought that he had defiled the temple. You think about all of the natural disasters that the Christians went through in the book of Acts. Paul mentions that he's shipwrecked. Luke records that for us after they've been blown around the Mediterranean for a couple of weeks. The Christians go through a famine in Judea. Paul is bitten by a viper.
Most random thing ever. He's on Malta, and this thing comes out of the bush and fixes itself on him. And evidently, that viper is so poisonous that the locals were just watching him like hawks, waiting for him to fall down dead. And he never does, and then they're caused to fear the Lord as well. See, you have all kinds of things, all kinds of people that could have been terrifying for the Christians. No, and it wasn't, and they weren't frightened at all. And you think about the world that we live in, there are so many opportunities for us to be full of fear of things other than the Lord. The virus is probably the most recent example of that, but there are many others that we could talk about. You have people kind of aligning themselves on a spectrum. You got the people who are terrified of the virus itself, and they base their security and their mental peace completely on the back of science, which can be very helpful. It can sometimes be faulty. And so I'm going to get the vaccine. I'm going to base my thoughts on that. But then you have people who aren't scared of the virus at all, but they are scared of other things. They're scared of government overreach. They're scared of regulations. They're scared of the economy collapsing if we shut things down. So the point is, regardless of where you fall on that spectrum, and I think most of us are probably somewhere in between those two extremes, regardless of where you fall, you are going to be tempted to fear something other than your God, and to align yourself with that and cause your peace to be wrapped up in those things. And so none of us, should arrogantly point our fingers at somebody else's fear. If we're over here and we're looking at people on the other side of the spectrum, to point our finger at them and laugh when we probably have unwholesome fears still within us in our hearts that need to be gotten rid of. I'll say for myself personally, I don't lose sleep over a lot of the hot button cultural issues that a lot of people get wrapped up in our media. What the president does or says doesn't keep me up at night. The virus is not really a big thing on my personal day-to-day radar. But I tell you, that there are other kinds of fears that shouldn't keep me up at night but do. Satan does have targets in my heart that he shoots his arrows at, sometimes with great effect. I do have fears. And when you look inside of your heart, you probably can see fears other than God as well. These passages challenge us to put our fears correctly in order. To not get rid of fear altogether, but to channel our fear in the right direction to the person to which it belongs. He is the only one worthy of it. So what are your fears? Are there ways in which you fear man? Or ways in which you fear natural disasters or other things that we might encounter? How do we get out of that? The way to get out of that is not tuning into a bunch of podcasts about the power of positive thinking. It's not about all of the different things that you could try to grab at in our culture that might seem like they could help, but don't really, because they're not anchored in a firm spiritual foundation in the Lord. The more we become fearful of the power and the character of our God, the less we will be consumed and eaten up by the fear of the world and what's in it. So it strips away our fears of anyone or anything else. But here's what it adds. Here's what it builds. It builds a love of what the Lord loves. You know, when you have your eyes fixed on someone, you want to know everything about that person. And we understand how that works in war. Like if there is an enemy, if there is a foe that our nation is at war with, if you talk about World War II, if you talk about any other war, our nation, our intelligence agencies work around the clock to try to write briefs about who the enemy is, what they eat for breakfast, what they're building, what their long-term plans are. Because you can't fight an enemy until you understand and get into their head and know what they're going to do before they do it, so that you can get there ahead of time and beat them. So we understand how that works with war. We also understand how that works with romance. You know, if you have your eyes fixed on a person because you are fascinated by them, attracted to them, you want to know everything about that person so that you can develop a relationship. So we understand how that works in a lot of areas of life. That's the way it works with the Lord. If you are fearful of the Lord, if you have your eyes fixed on Him, you're going to find out what He loves. And so what does God love in the story of Scripture? What does He fix His eyes upon? He loves us. He gives Himself for us from page 1 to the last page of the book in Revelation. He intentionally sacrifices the life of His Son to save people. He serves and He helps people. Hebrews makes a big deal about that. It's not angels that He helps. It's the sons of Abraham. It's us. And so sometimes in our public teaching that happens here, we make a big deal about the fact that we ought to be spending more time together. We ought to be rubbing elbows with each other more. And that's all true. And there's no diminishing that point. But where does the motivation come from to connect with each other more closely, to work side by side in the kingdom more closely? It doesn't come from, oh, you know, our personalities are so similar. Oh, we have all these hobbies and interests that are in common with each other. It comes from all of us putting the fear of God within our hearts more. If you go back to Acts chapter 2, it says they were breaking bread with each other inside their homes. They were spending time together. They were with each other all the time, whether it's at the temple or other places. But how did that happen? Verse 43, awe or fear came upon every soul. That's why they hung out. That's why they worked. That's why they taught with each other. And so that's probably one of my greatest fears right now about starting the Family Groups project. I think it's a good project. I think we should start it, and we should divide up into homes, and we should spend time together and eat with each other and do all those things. But I don't want any of us to enter into that project thinking that just doing those activities are automatically just going to lead to more closeness. Let's not put the cart in front of the horse. It's fear of God that drives us closer to Him and closer to each other. Everything else is artificial if that's not in place. So that has to be at the core of what we do and of who we are. It's interesting when you think about what Christianity looks like from the perspective of everybody in the world. They hear what Jesus says, and this was even true when Jesus was alive on this earth and walking around and doing His teaching here. He taught things like, if you want to be My disciple, you've got to take up your cross every day and follow Me. That is a terrifying thought, and that's why a lot of His disciples and followers faded away. And sometimes He was just basically left with the 12. Christianity can be terrifying from a worldly perspective. But from a heavenly viewpoint, walking with Jesus is the safest place to go. Now, sometimes Jesus is going to say, I need you to step into the back seat and let Me take the wheel. And you need to surrender your life completely to Me. And you need to let Me be the one to drive the vehicle. And I'm going to take you down some dark and sketchy alleys on our way to the city of light. But you need to trust Me that because I love you, because I showed I love you by what I did on the cross, I am worthy of your unguarded respect. I'm worthy of you to just hand your life over to Me completely so that I can do with it whatever I think is best. Walking with the Lord is a fearful activity, but if we have our eyes on Him, that is the safest place to go. That is what protects us from the harm of our enemy. And that is what we'll think about as we think about the cross now with the Lord's Supper. You think about all the fear that was within the hearts of the disciples
when they watched that happen. They watched him in his trials. They watched him go to the cross from a distance, but several of them were hanging around on the outskirts. That looked like, it looked like the world falling apart. But on the third day, Jesus demonstrated that that was not the end. That was merely the beginning of what he was doing, which he continues to do to this day. The churches of Judea and Samaria and Galilee grew because they had the fear of the Lord in them. And we will grow if we have the same thing within us.